Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today I'm interviewing Madison Denny. She's from Michelson and Robinson, all the way in Houston. She is a powerhouse attorney, really like a high-stakes trial lawyer. And she's trusted general counsel who really is operating at the junction of science, medicine, compliance, and innovation, all of this. She's helping us in aesthetics and healthcare and devices kind of navigate all the legal and regulatory challenges that are coming up, and they're coming fast and furious. I think technology is changing at a rate that is way faster than regulatory is keeping up, and we're having to innovate, and maybe we are walking the line of the Wild West. But we're going to talk to Madison about all the kind of interesting regulatory dilemmas that we're seeing right now in aesthetics, up to and including PDGF, platelet derived growth factors, exosomes, polynucleotides, all kinds of stuff. Welcome to the podcast, Madison.
Thank you, Dr. K. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'd love to start with your story and what kind of drew you first to the intersection of law and science and aesthetics and medicine.
Sure. So out of law school, and actually during law school, I clerked for a law firm that specialized in healthcare litigation, meaning we handled lawsuits and trials on behalf of healthcare providers, big and small. So the hospital corporations, the physician groups nationwide, practices, and we did everything from slip and falls to what we refer to as baby cases. So brain damage baby cases, birth injury cases, high value, high stakes cases. So I started my practice there, got a ton of trial experience at that firm. And then I started taking in my own clients that specifically were in the aesthetic space. And so I was providing them outside general counsel advice and also taking on lawsuits that they were hit with relevant to our space. So anything from injuries from product liability as a result of laser injuries to board actions that the med spas are, you know, open to. So then I went from that law firm, I built my own book of business, and I transitioned to Michelson and Robinson, which is a full service law firm. So we provide areas of expertise in most areas of the law. So corporate, transactional, kind of everything, which gave me the ability to service my clients on a more broad spectrum. So I still do kind of generally the same in terms of trial work. I love to try cases. That's where I'm really happy. But I also love to be in a boardroom with my clients, giving general business advice and perspective from the legal realm and aesthetics. So that's the long answer.
I love it. And now I think you've come to the forefront of some of these discussions. I've been on a panel with you last year about exosomes and polynucleotides, and like, what are the biggest pitfalls that practices are getting into in med spas in aesthetics right now? Like, where are we crossing the line, and where do we need to be careful?
So I think in terms of crossing the line, providers are taking maybe legal advice from friends and family and social media rather than trusted legal advisors. So one of the reasons I dove into the issue of PDGF, which we'll eventually talk about, is because I was attending conferences and speaking at conferences, one of the only lawyers present, but hearing a lot of legal dialogue and conversation. And it was a lot of very much speculative, very much confidently given, but maybe not by the right people. And so I wanted to figure out the answers and be somebody that could be trusted enough to give those answers kind of on a wider scale, make people feel more comfortable about their practice, kind of introducing regenerative medicine into it and how to navigate that.
I think in regenerative medicine in particular is the area where there is a lot of gray. And I think one big question people have is, what are you allowed to do? Can you explain the difference between off-label and on-label use of products, FDA-approved products?
Sure. And let me start by setting what I think is a really important foundation for this conversation, which is that the FDA regulates devices and products and drugs. They don't regulate the practice of medicine. And I say that because a lot of the conversation between providers is really rooted in the practice of medicine, and that's governed by the standard of care and the board, right? So the FDA is really their concern is making sure that manufacturers of devices and drugs are promoting them, that they are approved for both safety and efficacy, and that they are put out into commercial use in the most safe, you know, regulated way possible. And that's just very different than the way that the providers' use of those same things are seen through the lens of standard of care and board. So back to the definitions and what we're concerned about with off-label and on-label use. So with both off-label and on-label use, the underlying drug or product has an FDA approval, right? Now that approval comes with what's called an indication. So basically the reason why you're using it. And so if, for example, the indication is for, soft tissue application or injection, that would be an on, so like a Botox, that would be an on-label use if you were to inject it in the face, right? But then off-label comes into question if you're using it like pre-Botox approval, where it was expanded use to the face for aesthetics purposes. It was first approved for, I believe it was an eye condition, right? And so that indication was expanded through clinical use when the clinical data showed that it was providing aesthetic promise and data and results driven to an expanded use for aesthetics. So that's kind of how it evolved. And it's very typical to have an on-label use kind of expanded through just kind of years of off-label use and data derived from that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Although I think a lot of people in aesthetics are mentioning companies that are aware of product usage that's outside of normal realm of use. And like this definition of what's allowed in medicine and what creative powers can we use is kind of, I think in a lot of ways, pushing limits. Like at what point do we need to ask industry to step up and do some testing to be sure that the manner in which people are using this product actually is safe?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think that pushing industry to do things the right way is absolutely fair. I think also there's a reality where there may be an attempt to do things the right way that industry can't always share, right? Because it's either proprietary or strategic against competitors to make sure that it's done effectively and within the confines of the regulations. And so, you know, it is easy to say, let's push the manufacturers and push industry to really guide us through and navigate these waters. But also, by the way, it costs millions of dollars and tons
really
of
does.
Data and lots of years. And so I think the best practice is to work together, right? And to do it in a productive way and not kind of putting each other down in the process, but to build each other up. And there is a way to do that, that I hope today we can talk about and really shed light on so that it's effective.
There almost needs to be a task force to go to the FDA to ask them to evaluate these products differently and better so it doesn't cost millions of dollars to even just do a pilot trial, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I really feel like we're at that convergence point where the biotech has advanced so, so fast and we can't all do rare disease indications for pushing through one drug at $5 million. It's just going to stop innovation in our industry. The other interesting thing is other countries have the power to use these products and have been using these products like for the last 10 years safely and with published clinical studies. And it's interesting that none of that translates and comes over to the U.S. market.
I know. I agree. And if you're an innovator of medicine and you believe in that and you want to advocate for that, there is a forum for you. I mean, companies are always looking for opinion leaders that are interested in pushing forward innovation in a clinically sound way. And I mean, one of the examples I've been giving a lot recently is there is a way to leverage and utilize existing data, clinical data that a lot of these providers on the PDGF issue, for example, have hundreds of patients that have already been treated with this drug. And, you know, there's a reason why the FDA allows you to do like look back data and retroactive studies and chart review, because there is this acknowledgement that providers are using it safely and effectively in their treatment plans. And so you should be able to utilize that data and share it to, you know, to the audience that deserves it, which is the FDA, so that we can move forward with innovation. in a practice.
Sure. It's very important that some people that are out there that have platforms and are using the products actually take the time to do a clinical write-up and even report, even if it's just a few case studies. Each case we learn about is going to advance the cause and the understanding of how to use it. What can we do in a practical sense? Like, let's say I want to be cutting edge and I want to try use these FDA-approved products in an off-label manner. Are there some practicalities like risk mitigation and insurance coverage or consent forms that I need to dive into? I know you have answers here.
I better. So I think, you know, first of all, I would say, you know, if you are interested in regenerative medicine, I think first and foremost, you should have a trusted legal advisor that knows the space, especially if you want to delve into and explore new treatments that possibly aren't covered or approved by the FDA. So you're using treatments or products or prescribing drugs that are not approved at all. That's not off-label use, as I explained earlier. That's unapproved use, which is still accessible to providers. But you just have to make sure you're doing it within the confines of the law. And so, you know, obviously a trusted legal advisor to explain those nuances to you, and then a partner with your insurance company, whether that's a broker or directly with the insurer themselves, to make sure that you are fully covered. I've heard rhetoric that insurers are not covering PDGF, for example, and I know that to be false. I've seen policies that explicitly allow that. And I would say if I think people lose sight of the fact that as a provider getting MedMal insurance and other types of insurance, you are the customer. You can dictate what broker you use, what insurance policy you buy. It's a service. So make sure and utilize someone who can adapt the policy to your practice. Be honest with them. Be transparent with them. Because if you're both, you know, acting within the confines of what your legal advisor tells you and you're covered through insurance, and then lastly, you have buttoned up paperwork in terms of consent and, you know, full documentation, then you are much less at risk for, you know, the big bad lawsuits coming your way. And I will just say that legal disputes, in my experience, having, you know, litigated them and created strategies to mitigate against them, they don't come from complications alone. They come from poor or completely obsolete documentation. And then obviously a deviation from the standard of care, which is set by a multitude of factors.
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. If your insurance company shuts you down, your malpractice says, oh no, we feel weird, we're not covering this, then are you just out of luck? Are you going to get a different malpractice company or?
So I guess it depends on when they ditch you, right? So if you are facing a rejection of a claim, for example, then they won't cover costs associated with defending you in your case or before the board, which means you're out of pocket. In that instance, it's going to be really hard to find a insurer that will retroactively cover something because who wants to sign up for a known risk and a known issue. But obviously, you know, that's why I think it's really important that you have a solid relationship with your broker and your insurer to make sure that you're covered.
Interesting. So would you suggest that practices should just have a list of like, I think I brought on 10 new products this year, whether it's exosome, polynucleotide, PDGF, Ariesence, or other stuff. Should I just be sending a laundry list to my malpractice? Like, these are all the new products I bought on this year.
I think, you know, well, first I would make sure that you're,
I'm planning to bring on this year.
First I would make sure that, first and foremost, if you're worried about off-label use, I would make sure that there's not a carve out in your policy that, you know, excludes coverage for off-label. Honestly, in 2025, I think that you should be making sure that you have the ability, especially as a surgeon, to make that medical decision as you deem fit, as a reasonably prudent physician would. And so I would definitely ensure you don't have a carve out for off-label use. And then to the extent that you have a particular product that you want to use, treat, prescribe that is not FDA approved at all right now, I would be talking to your broker or your insurer about getting that exclusion. I mean, not exclusion, inclusion in your policy so that you're covered if an event were to arise as a result of whatever the treatment is. And again, don't be scared of the insurer. This is not something that they're going to use against you necessarily. It's a conversation you should feel free to have with someone you're paying money for a policy for.
Yeah, very true. Well, so Madison, in terms of informed consent, can a provider actually give an informed consent on a product that there is relatively new and that they don't know the track record of it and they don't know like the 5-year outcome, 10-year outcome on this product?
So again, I would say transparency is key. The purpose of an informed consent is to inform the patient with what you know. And so if what you know is that you are providing them with a treatment or a drug or a product or a device that you believe is safe and effective for use for this particular patient, then what you can do is just also make them aware of the known risks, which are that, you know, it is not FDA approved, meaning it hasn't gone through the approval process. That there are certain complications that could arise, just like any informed consent. But also just know that while I do believe that informed consents are an asset, I will tell you, Dr. K, as a recovering MedMal trial lawyer, mm-hmm. that rarely did I have a case where there weren't informed consents, and rarely did I have a case where I won because there was an informed consent. Again, it's one factor that goes into the analysis of how the case shakes out and whether the standard of care was followed. It's not going to save the day, but it certainly helps in terms of the overall picture and mitigating risk.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And is it enough to be transparent to say, well, these are the logical reasons why this product should work and the scientific rationale of using it, and then these are my expected outcomes, but I can't promise you that outcome.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of data, but from the current small data that we do have, we think this is fair and safe to try, and we would feel comfortable.
Generally, informed consents are judged on one time I had a jury judge informed consent because, you know, there's no way they could have possibly been informed because the font was in size 2 font and no one could have ever read what you presented to them, right? So it didn't even matter about the substance. It was really the reality of whether or not it could actually be read or a patient could read it if they wanted to. I haven't had an issue where the informed consent didn't meet certain parameters and therefore was irrelevant to the case, right? Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, as long as you are transparent and you identify the risks and complications and you give the right informed consent for the treatment that you're doing that it's relevant for, it can serve as a tool and an asset.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently you published a piece in Modern Aesthetic magazine where I'm one of the executive editors, and it was a great piece all about the legal landscape surrounding PDGF or Areessence, the platelet-derived growth factor. What inspired you to tackle this topic?
I brought this up a little bit earlier, but I wrote because I kept hearing non-lawyers try to diagnose a very nuanced legal issue. And I watched as the audience, you know, was clearly very insecure in the answers that were provided, and that there was a takeaway from the conferences I went to where there were, you know, large audiences, but still massive confusion about these issues. And I just thought, what better person to take advantage of where the confusion lies and how I can try to help untangle this mess in a clear kind of, very objective manner. And I think one thing that's been lost in all of this is, for example, my publication it's not opinion based. It is not an op-ed. It is just very definition based. It is very factually oriented. It does not speak about a particular product. It just says, you know, these are the definitions for on-label, off-label. This is how you navigate through these legal processes. And I just wanted to clear up the misunderstanding over a lot of the terms being thrown around.
So we've talked about a few different things. How do you think the bioregenerative products like exosomes, peptides, polynucleotides, how does that differ from conventional injectables?
So I think it differs, especially right now, under the regulatory framework, because it, you know, obviously there's a huge light shed on the new regenerative medicine and the pathways to using it. I think it's an area that is innovating faster than the regulatory, than regulation can actually keep up with. And so it's taking a lot longer to explain kind of the modalities and the sources for these products and the manufacturing process, and all of that is not aligned with the standard injectables that for a long time, just kind of stayed stagnant in terms of what was available to the market. And so it's just a new area. And I think with new comes, you know, fear and also education and trying to figure out how to introduce it in the market in a safe way, but to keep up with innovation. It's just a really hard task.
Yeah, I think so. Like people who want to bring peptides into their practice have the added difficulty of like sourcing the products from a legal and reliable manufacturer, compounding pharmacy. Like not, I think patients listening should be wary of drugs labeled as research products. And they genuinely need to be only coming from compounding pharmacies that make manufacture things sterilely and with the proper ingredients that have been vetted. Because there have been actually people who have gone into kidney failure, liver failure, coma, respiratory failure. They are serious drugs.
Yeah, and I think another difference that I think is known but maybe overlooked is the fact that we're introducing this new area of medicine at a time where the spotlight is really on providers through the lens of the consumer, because they have access every day to social media to learn about what these products are and to also be fearful about what they could be. And there's just a lot of rhetoric out there that I think is maybe being misunderstood by both providers and consumers alike. And that wasn't true necessarily 10 or 15 years ago, right? With some of the injectables that we've known for a long time, they weren't on the stage that regenerative medicine is on right now. And it just makes it even harder to navigate.
So, all right. So I think if you could give every entrepreneur out there in aesthetics a legal North Star to follow and keep in mind as they start doing things, what would that be?
Just generally speaking, I think from a business perspective, to partner with true experts in the field, whether that's through mentorship in clinical practice or mentorship in business practice. So trusted advisors, both in, I think the initial inclination is to do it, you know, centered around clinical, but center it around, you know, this being your business too. And so with that comes financial and legal risk. And I think it's just really important to find partners that understand that and also sympathize with the business obstacles that you're facing that are unique to aesthetics and different than other kind of segments in healthcare.
Yeah. So maybe you find someone who's doing it right, who's been doing it for 20 years, then you kind of model your practice after that. We were talking about peptides and the wild west of medicine out here in LA. I have crazy patients that are influencers who are like, they work out at gyms where all the sports bros are shooting up peptides and hormones. And then they themselves just put an Instagram tag that they can get peptides for all of their girlfriends. And I was just like horrified. I'm like, where is the medical board in all of this process, and who is protecting the patients, and do people even know what they're injecting?
And yeah, I mean, to that point, I feel the same way. I feel the same way with kind of legal advice and how it's being thrown around. And especially like the reason I told you I brought kind of this issue to light after going to these conferences, because it's the same problem that I'm trying to solve for, which is that you have very sophisticated people that are taking advice and counsel from social media. And I think it's misguided and misunderstood. And, you know, I think it's a real threat to innovation as well, because, you know, the boards and the FDA, as proactive as they also are very reactive. And so what do we want them reacting to? The data and the studies and what we're submitting for approval, or social media noise? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, honestly, we need to be more vocal with like putting out some scientific or clinical fact.
Yes.
So I think it's really important. What are some of the high stakes cases that you've been through recently that highlight practitioner risk?
So from a practitioner risk perspective, I would say, I think that lasers have come a long way in terms of catching the eye of plaintiff's attorneys. And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, laser injuries for most instances are minor, right? In comparison to other complications and other, you know, adverse events that arise from cosmetic and aesthetic medicine. You know, it's not life threatening. They're not, you know, usually going to result in permanent disfigurement. That said, you know, the more cases that are being filed that plaintiff's attorneys can latch on to and get an understanding for who the experts are in their, on their side and what the value of those cases are worth, the more you see popping up. And that's kind of true for everything, Dr. K, in terms of trends for medical malpractice and what issues I see coming up is they take a little bit to gain traction. And when they do, it's easier to pick up plaintiffs along the way, which is also my fear for regenerative medicine is that a lot of this conversation and noise around it is only creating a playbook for plaintiff's attorneys and plaintiffs out there that maybe don't have a case or don't have a worthwhile case, or it might be hard to prove a deviation of the standard of care. But man, certainly this noise is not helping prevent that. You know, you're kind of setting the stage for them.
Yeah, I would agree, but I do think practitioners have to be a little wary and careful because there have been arrests and jail time issued for treatments where I'm sure they thought they were doing the best interest for the patient, but it wasn't interpreted that way according to the letter of the law. What kind of cases would that be?
Yeah, I think you've got to be really responsible. I think a lot of the concern coming from the legislation in the various state legislation trying to prevent some of the harm is really related to sourcing and not having an understanding of whether or not what product is being sourced is actually safe or, you know, sourced responsibly. And that was where I think the early concern came from with the, you know, on the earlier side of exosomes and peptides and all of that, was really there's no way to regulate this because we don't know where it's coming from, whether it's, you know, coming from foreign places or, you know, being prepared by a not professional compound pharmacist that is just maybe a person in their kitchen. So I think sourcing is really the underlying issue there.
So PDGF and this product is an FDA-approved substance, and so it falls kind of into a different class than maybe exosomes as well as polynucleotides and peptides that are not FDA-approved for use anywhere in the body. Is that right?
Right. Right. So PDGF is unique to this conversation in regenerative medicine and certainly around the regulatory framework because currently there are four approved products by the FDA. That have the component of pure PDGF. And the really important thing, the distinction there too, and kind of what's unique to Ariessence would be that the founder and the inventor of that, pure PDGF component is the same one for the other four that have been approved. And so this is a person who has had, the clinical data, has been through the rigorous, you know, approval studies, clinical data, FDA regulatory scheme to get those approved. And so with exosomes and peptides, for example, you know, they're still behind the mark in terms of having a component that's actually approved that they can track data with and clinical studies with. And so I think that does kind of make it there's a distinction there. There's still unapproved use, but there's a distinction there that I think that separates it clinically, if that makes sense, from the safety and efficacy standpoint, if we're judging it on the FDA approval.
Yeah, I think that's a very important distinction because PDGF has been through years of clinical testing and is safe not only at the different sites where it was approved in the oromaxillofacial and alveolar bone and for diabetic ulcers and for joint and orthopedic use, but the systemic result of using the products was tested and found to be safe systemically, which to me, this is the gold standard of what safety is. So, yes, we should probably have a little more studies in terms of like clinically what dose and how to apply it and how to, you know, optimize results. But also I think there's a really significant amount of safety data that's available for it. So that's a product that, you know, I would feel very good about using in an off-label manner. However, other things, like you said, the polynucleotides, it doesn't help me that 10 years they've been injecting it in Korea because I'm still not allowed to inject it in the U.S. Is that right?
Right. I mean, unfortunately, the FDA does not hinge its decision making on what other countries are doing. Very American of us. But I do think in terms of medical malpractice and defending yourself, Dr. K, I would say it is a factor that you could rely on to prove that you are well versed in understanding the science behind it. So it's not completely irrelevant when we talk about the use in other countries. Mm-hmm. But for purposes of getting it approved in the United States, it doesn't hinge on the use in another country, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I see people advertising things like, come get your IV exosomes. Like very big companies here in LA are in this, you know, Next Health is one of them. And I'm just a little concerned because when I see IV exosomes, it's usable for an investigational new drug designation study, but not
right.
For consumer on the consumer menu. So like, I'm kind of wondering like what's going on with
right.
that.
Right. And I think that it's fair to kind of be concerned about what's advertised and promoted, which is exactly why regulations exist, kind of with an oversight principle to that. But I think it's fair to question whether or not that's appropriate. And I think it's also fair to do your own kind of due diligence for your own practice and not assume that because it's being advertised or because it's being shared on social media as appropriate, that it would necessarily be appropriate for you. Every state's different. Every board has different sets of regulations. And so you just have to be very much aware. I mean, you're running a business, right? So you've got to be aware of like what regulates that business and what doesn't.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But it just makes me worried for the whole industry. Like, well, these exosomes are a powerful tool. We want to be able to have that. We don't want some regulatory agency shutting that down because somebody's advertising prematurely. Like, I think it's really important that they should go to a state where that kind of stuff is not going to be scrutinized as much as it is in California.
Yeah. Right. And again, there's always a pathway to trying to figure out how to kind of participate if innovating in that area is important to you and you feel passionate about it. There is definitely an avenue for you to pursue that and kind of be the one who sets the standard of care with respect to using.
What does it take to get an IND for a new drug designation? Is that a big, huge process or can anyone who's scientifically interested try that?
Well, it is a financial investment, so you have to be able to pay for it. But it's not a total barrier of entry in terms of the financial component. Oftentimes, manufacturers or the drug companies themselves will help sponsor them privately and help you kind of pay for it as a physician. And so there are those options, but certainly I think the cost prohibitive nature of it is probably what ends up keeping people out of it. And that's a shame because I think, again, the more dialogue you have with the drug companies, the more interest you show in advocating for the medicine, the better off you are in terms of cooperating and setting up the field for success.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think you've brought up so many really great points. How can people find you if they want to reach out and do a legal consult or do a deep dive into how their office is set up and like what are the parameters they need to adjust?
Sure. So my firm, Michaelman and Robinson, I'm online. You can search me, Madison Deeney, with Michaelman and Robinson, or you can email me. That's always appropriate. It's at mrllp.com. And
we'll put that in the show notes too. We'll put that in the show notes. Dini is D-I-N-I.
It is.
Okay, good. And if there was one thing you would be doing outside of practicing law, what would that be?
Oh gosh, it's so hard. I'm a mom of three very little kids. So really my time is completely taken by either the practice of law or my three kids and helping them grow up and just being there for them.
I love that. Well, kids are, that's the most important thing we do in our lives. But then it's great that you have your career because then they grow up and then you get to innovate and reinvent yourself again. Well, guys, that's it for now. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, D-R-K-A-Y, doing amazing things with people's faces and doing all those next level bioregenerative treatments. So I'm trying to learn the law and stay within the guidelines of what's good and true and right for our patients. And we have to have resources like the brilliant Madison Denny, who's going to teach us the path. So I hope you learned a lot. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.